lucky star. I saw.
Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly cable program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is William T. Volman, author of the new novel, The Lucky Star, from Viking Press. Volman is the author of four collections of short fiction, a memoir, seven works of nonfiction, including the seven-volume treatise on violence, Rising Up and Rising Down, and 11 novels, including the National Book Award-winning Europe Central, and the five books currently available in Bill's Seven Dreams series of historical fiction. His journalism and stories have appeared in New Yorker, Harper's, Esquire, Granta, and many other publications. In an Esquire review, Mark Warren writes of Volman, "So mysterious are his motivations, so sweeping are his interests, so prodigious is his production, so vastly different is the thing he does from the thing that everyone else does, that he may actually be a visitor from another dimension, come to report comprehensively back to his home planet." Bill Volman, thanks for joining us in Between the Covers and traveling all the way from your home planet, otherwise known as Sacramento.
The least I could do. Yeah, it was an easy teleportation ride.
Even another dimension and another planet, my.
Yeah, what could be better? Well, it's great to see you again, my friend.
I always look forward to this, and I cherish our interviews. This is our fourth one. The last was for your two-volume work on climate change, Carbon Ideologies. That was about 2 years ago. So The Lucky Star is your first published book since then. I want to first put it in context. You write in The Lucky Star's afterword that it's the last volume in what you call your transgender trilogy. That includes The Book of Dolores that was published in 2013 and as yet, at least, unpublished manuscript called How You Are.
That's right.
How You Are is a novel about a transgender woman named Dolores and The Book of Dolores, which is a nonfiction book of photographs, art, essays. Of you taking on the persona of a transgendered woman named Dolores came out of the research for How You Are? Is that how it came about? How You Are came first and then The Book of Dolores?
Or? I was working on both of them at the same time. And, you know, they were both works of imagination. And, you know, to be a writer, to be an imaginer is to really live in one's head. So I thought, well, suppose that Dolores were really going to be brave and not live in her head, then what kind of life would she have? And I thought, almost certainly, she would come to a bad end. And this is what I might as well describe all the horrible things that happened to her.
And that's the novel itself.
Yeah that's right. Yeah.
And then The Book of Dolores was you taking on the persona of Dolores. So there's a kind of a Bill Volman Dolores, and then there's the fictional character Dolores.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, The Book of Dolores is a set of transgender self-portraits with some descriptions of the various technical processes such as gum printing or silver gelatin, you know, by which these images were made.
And when you were planning that out, How You Are and The Book of Dolores, was The Lucky Star something in your mind too as a third book in a trilogy, or did that come along after these two volumes?
That came along much later. And when I first started writing The Lucky Star, I thought that it was really going to be about Neva. And then I realized that it's at least as much about the transgender woman
named Judy.
And after all, Neva is something approximating a goddess. Not quite, you know, maybe a demigoddess. And so it gets a little harder to imagine oneself inside a goddess's head. So why not fall back on the people who are flawed and limited like me?
And that would be Judy in the book. And, of course, the friends of Neva and, in effect, they're apostles in the book, disciples.
That's right.
Of Neva as the goddess.
That's right. And so when we first look in on them, you know, they tend to seem kind of sad and brutal and pathetic. And that's because to somebody like Neva, to any god or goddess, we all have to be very, very imperfect. So from her perspective, that's how we all are. And, you know, I'm an equal opportunity hater, as I always say. So people who read the book carefully will see that it's not just in the bar, but, you know, the names of whiskey and cars and everything else. The whole world is equally degraded.
And some of those are very, very funny. You make up some names of beers, whiskeys, internet sites, email addresses.
Yeah, I had fun. My production editor at Viking, this really wonderful guy named Bruce Giffords, who always helps me, would occasionally call me and say, you know, Bill, I checked this and there's actually a supermarket with that ridiculous name or a website with that name. And then I would have to sit down and come up with something even more stupid and peculiar. So that was quite fun. Yeah.
Now, before we get more into Lucky Star, I'm just curious about how you are. That's we said that was a as yet unpublished manuscript.
That's right.
Will that be finding a publisher soon with Viking or someone else?
It's hard to say. When I first finished the book, I sent it to Viking, and they said, absolutely no way.
And I think on our last interview, I learned that it was considered, what, too obscene to publish? Was there a reason there? Of course, that's very amorphous description.
Right. Yeah. It made them very, very uncomfortable. And, of course, this was several years ago when people were less comfortable with fluid gender identity and, you know, transgender stuff and so forth. And most of the transgender people that I know and work with are street prostitutes. So that's a particular kind of world that a lot of people don't want to know about. And then there are people who are advocates for transgender women who think, you know, we don't want it to be about that. You know, so there were all kinds of reasons, I think, why Viking didn't want it. And then I sent it to an editor of mine at The New Yorker, and she said, you know, Bill, I fear for you if this is published.
In terms of criticism or actual?
Who knows? Criticism, violence, whatever. And I was kind of shocked. You know, I've sent it to some European friends, and they thought it was not such a big deal. But for now, I think after the Lucky Star, you know, if I live long enough, I'd like to finish the other two Seven Dreams. And then we'll see. You know, maybe then I'll publish How You Are. There's no hurry.
Still very curious, because How You Are, is that much different than The Lucky Star? I mean, that also has at least one transgender woman as a main character, and there's another transgender woman in there also.
Right. Well, you know, it's in terms of being sexually explicit, it's probably not that different from The Lucky Star. It's a much sadder, more horrific book than Lucky Star. And Lucky Star, you know, is sad or not too sad, depending on whether you believe that Neva is Jesus and whether you believe in the resurrection. If Jesus wasn't resurrected, then it's kind of a crummy story.
So there are parallels there, but I didn't want to give the ending away of The Lucky Star. Now, in the book's foreword, very candid afterward, it was extremely helpful to me to prepare for the interview. You write that even though it was published, publication was delayed for about a year over a disagreement over the title with your publisher, Viking. You wanted to call the book The Lesbian, but Viking was adamantly against it. They said if you were a woman and a lesbian, it would be okay, and you were clearly 0 for 2 on that count.
Unfortunately.
Right. Did they give you any reasons for that requirement? They were just scared of the response from the literary community and from readers? Or?
I think so. And I don't think that actually publication was delayed. It's just that, you know, when I would say, well, you know, so I'm working on The Lesbian, and then the answer I would be, well, for now, we're just going to refer to that as untitled novel. I thought, no, that doesn't sound
well,
too
good. Well, that's unique. Yeah.
Yeah. As the Bible says, sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. So let's just kick that can down the freeway until we have to open it up and see how many worms are inside it.
And when you did open it up and saw how many worms, they asked you to submit a list of Plan B titles?
Right. And I almost didn't do it. And then, you know, Ken, I thought, I played a game of chicken with them about Lucky Star. Many's the time when they've said, oh, Bill, you have to cut it by a third, and I never do.
Yes, and, that was true for the dying grass. I remember you told me that story. You were contractually limited to 800 pages, and you turned in about 1,400.
Yeah, that's right. You know, just a little glitch on the bell curve.
But here they weren't giving in.
Right. And with Carbon Ideologies, I basically had to say, okay, I'm going to withdraw this book. And then finally they saw it my way.
With some compromise, it was published in two volumes.
And moved some stuff around. So it was not ideal, but on the whole, I have to be very grateful. And so my first instinct was to do what I always do, which is just to refuse to compromise. And then I thought, well, particularly because, you know, my editor, Paul Slovak, is such a good friend, and he really was trying to make it work. And I said, you know, Paul, can't you just talk to them? And he said, you know, Bill, I've always tried to defend your interests, but I just don't think I could do it this time. And I just imagined the poor guy in a meeting saying, nope, Vollman's not giving in. And I felt sorry for him. And maybe they made me a little afraid, too. I don't know. But
well, you have a long history with not only Paul, but also the publisher Viking.
Yeah. I'm very proud to be a Viking author. And I thought, if I never give in, that's bad. If I always give in, that's bad. So let me give in this once. And I still think that it was quite foolish to make me change the title. And someday it will come out, I hope, with the original title, The Lesbian. And in the meantime, you know, of all the alternative titles I came up with, Lucky Star is...
Because of the Judy Garland analogy, yes.
So it's a perfectly okay title.
And that was a title, I think you described in the afterword, that they actually chose from a list that you submitted?
Yeah, I gave them three or four titles.
Oh, just again, out of curiosity, is there any... do you remember any of the others? Or?
Oh, let's see. The other one that was in the running, I thought, was Better Than Life.
Ah.
That seemed very much about celebrity and drugs.
Yes,
and
we'll get into
Neva.
That. The book goes into those topics.
That's right, mm-hmm. Yeah. But Lucky Star probably has more punch.
Right.
So,
well, for what little it's worth, I actually like the title The Lesbian. After reading the book, I think it's more appropriate for...
It would have been better.
Yeah, but it resonates better once you've read the book.
Right. But it's okay. We'll live with it.
Now, you said when coming up for the idea of The Lucky Star, you were wondering what it would be like. You told me this, I think, if Jesus were a woman, and what would be the relationship between a female Jesus and her apostles? What was the appeal of that concept for you?
Well, you know, I was baptized as a Lutheran. My parents used to send me to Sunday school, and I always found the idea of a personal God who looked like me somewhat peculiar. And particularly the idea of God as an old man. And, you know, why wouldn't God be a frog or a star or anything else? But if I were going to imagine some kind of a loving deity, then of course what I would want would be a really, really sweet, affectionate, compassionate woman, you know, who would take me in her arms. So maybe, you know, the way that the Catholics feel about Virgin Mary, you know, I could relate to some kind of god or goddess like that. You know, when I really think about it, it seems, well, I'm not sure if there is a God, what kind of plan there is for us, and whatever that plan entails, it's probably in the interest of the whole and not necessarily in the interest of his or her creatures, you know, who are more or less like cockroaches. One time I was in Taliban, Afghanistan, and I met this, you know, this really militant Talib running around with his machine gun, and he told me that for a while during the war with Russia, he was in Bangkok, and he spent a lot of time in Pat Pong, the red light district, with all the prostitutes. And I said, oh, you know, I'm so sorry, sir, to ask you this question, but my impression was, you know, that, you know, based on what I've read of the Quran, that that's not, you know, the kind of thing that a Muslim is supposed to do, right, is to go out drinking and whoring. And he said, well, you know, Bill, the way I look at it, God is up really, really high in the air, and we're all like little ants, and he can hardly even see us.
He thought he was getting away with it.
Yeah, that's right. So that was his idea of a personal God.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Oh, he's busy. He's not going to know what I'm doing.
That's right. Yeah. And my idea is, oh, she loves me, and she'll hold me in her arms and forgive me.
Yeah. And I know I've been doing a lot of research, as I told you, on your work, and you've said in the past that you're not too fond of the gender of male, but we've pretty much messed up things, and women usually are required to come in and clean things up after we make our mess.
That's right. Yeah. And I feel comfortable with my male energy, and, you know, I love my male friends, but if I had to choose, yeah, I'd much rather be around women.
Now, it's not just gender here that you've kind of played with. The Christian concept is of a very asexual Jesus. The standard story is that Jesus never had sex in his life. Mary Magdalene was a good friend, but platonic, I guess. So the female Jesus in your book, though, Neva, is pansexual.
Right.
And prolifically pansexual, I would have to say. Her apostles, who hang out at a place called the Y Bar in San Francisco's Tenderloin District, which you've written about in many of your books.
Right.
They're diverse in terms of gender and sexual orientation, and she satisfies them all throughout the book, spiritually and sexually, often graphically described in the novel. And the book's narrator is a straight male named Richard. He describes having sex with Neve as being given the sacrament.
That's right. Yeah.
So really that connection between, well, I don't know, the sacred and profane, but definitely between the religious and the sexual, the physical. That, of course, is not Judeo-Christian, but you have this incredible grasp of the history of religion. There's epigraphs that go back thousands of years that you use in this book. So the gods there were a little more sexual than Jesus and some of the Jewish gods.
They were, and, you know, and if we could really go back, you know, to the time of the historic Jesus and the apostles, I wonder what we would see. You know, you remember Judas betrays him with a kiss. Now, was this like, you know, the kiss where Brezhnev had to kiss Kosygin? You know, those Slavic kind of kisses? Or was
those,
it something different?
Mafia kisses where it means something bad's going to happen.
Right, yeah, who knows? And in the Middle Ages, there is a period, I think it was in both France and Italy, the Catholic Church ran brothels, you know, to raise money for the church. You know, it's just that we go in and out of very, very prudish times. And the standards of what's acceptable, not just in terms of sexuality, but also gender stuff, is always changing. I found it so interesting, you know, when I was researching Dying Grass, that when General Canby was killed by the Modocs, at least one of his devoted soldiers burst into tears. You know, it was like not considered unmanly for a man to cry. And Custer's widow, Elizabeth, Libby as she was called, she writes, I think it's in Boots and Saddles, about this one soldier who was living with a washerwoman and some kind of, you know, marital type relationship. In those days, the washerwomen would follow the army. They were single women, and often they were prostitutes. Often there were relationships, even marriages between them and the soldiers. And it turned out that this particular washerwoman was another man. And instead of flying into, you know, a freak out about it, she said, and everyone else said, oh, you know, it's so interesting. Well, as long as they get along, you know, this was 1870s.
That's so amazing.
Yeah. So things are not what we think. And however things are now, they weren't that way before and they won't be that way again.
Now, one thing that Neva shares with many spiritual figures is the need to, or for her to sacrifice and also to suffer. And that's like Jesus in the wilderness, a Buddha under the Bodhi tree.
Right.
Both in both cases, it was something like 40 days, 49 days, of suffering and temptation. Now, in The Lucky Star, Karen Strand becomes Neva. She's transformed into this goddess by a group of witches on a magical island. I think somewhere off the coast of Seattle in the Puget Sound, but you don't really say.
Yes, yeah.
Now, though the witches love and accept her, the process they put her through is often a painful one for Neva. And in a great profile in Sacktown Magazine, which is one of my favorite articles on you, Bill, the writer Hillary Louise Johnson, she visits your studio in Sacramento and describes one of your paintings, and this is of the Norse god Odin. And you explain to her that he's gashing himself with a spear and hanging himself from a tree, abasing the flesh in order to receive wisdom. So you've got that relationship between religious enlightenment and suffering, and that seems to me a focus of the novel, or one of the focuses.
And it seems like something very common in many religions and initiation rituals. You have to lose something to gain something. You know, what does Jesus say? You know, he who wants to gain his life must lose it. My daughter, Lisa, was a little girl when I was telling her the Norse myths, and she had a very devout Algerian Muslim babysitter. So she was saying, yeah, I'm out. And then Odin gashed his eye out to get a drink from the water of the Well of Weird. And Amel said approvingly, very strict religion.
See, I didn't know that about Odin either, so yeah. I was surprised. But there does seem to be a thread that you've picked up on
Right. Throughout
the history of divinities and gods and spiritual beings, leaders.
And, you know, there's a lot of syncretic stuff in the Norse myths, like Baldur, you know, is probably a Jesus figure. And very possibly Odin was some sort of Jesus figure also. You know, they took the stuff that they could accept, you know, the hanging, the crucifixion, whatever, the suffering for a long time in exchange for some gain. But since they weren't exactly into peace and love and salvation, then they said, all right, well, what does he get out of it? Not eternal life. He already has that, at least till Ragnarok, but he gets the alphabet, the runes.
Uh-huh. So that's pretty good. So kind of knowledge.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, you also connect our worship of divinities, like Neva in the book, who's worshipped by her crowd at the Y Bar, with our current celebrity culture. And you reference several celebrities, of course, Judy Garland, but also Natalie Wood, Martina Navratilova's in there, Marlena Dietrich, Marilyn Monroe. there's quite a few names in there. And Natalie and Judy, in particular, they were both child stars and suffered really for their craft.
Quite
abusive parents, and they died fairly young under tragic circumstances, both of them. You write of Neva in the book, does a goddess in fact define herself or simply endure whichever misdefinitions our passionate loneliness project upon her? To never be alone again and never be unloved, to make others happy, to love and be loved as all of us are meant to do. Such was now her state, the loneliness of being loved. And that seems to me to apply to celebrities as well as goddesses.
I think so.
You call that in the afterword, does celebrity idolification.
Right, yeah. I read that term in a book about lesbian idols. It was a term they coined. I thought, yeah, that kind of sums it up. And so, again, it's a sacrificial process. And, you know, every time I go to the supermarket, it's always fun for me to look at the tabloids. I used to
just see who's on the front page. And I think it's Prince Andrew and who's the prince that just kind of left with his wife, Meghan Markle. And
That was Andrew, right? Yeah,
okay.
It's interesting that, you know, supposedly we think these people are perfect and we really, really would like to be like them, you know. So there are women who try to copy the look of a certain actress and so on and so forth. But then when you look at the tabloids, it's
always the dark side of celebrity.
Terrible thing that just happened, and so-and-so's been betrayed and this and that. And so there's a huge element of sadism, I think. And where would Jesus be without the crucifixion? That's what makes the story stick. And what a great career move, you know, for Natalie Wood to be drowned very, very young. Oh, poor Natalie, how glamorous that she died young, you know. It's really, really quite horrible, this stuff.
Yeah, in fact, I think you brought up Rebel Without a Cause in the book. She was a co-star with James Dean, who died very young.
That's right. Huh?
Yeah, in a car crash.
Yeah, I've been to supposedly the last restaurant that he ate at, you know.
That's just Central California, isn't it?
Yeah, down near Grapevine. Mm-hmm. And the food was so bad, I thought, yeah, no wonder he died.
It wasn't a car crash. No. It was food poisoning.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, I think one attraction for you in creating the sexualized female Jesus figure is a question you seek to explore in The Lucky Star. After Neva becomes a goddess, you write in the book, quote, "And now the story enters in upon its purpose, which is to establish whether the one can ever love the many as perfectly as the many are called upon to love the one." And this is a bigger issue when sex becomes part of that relationship, because jealousy enters the picture.
Right.
The desire for an exclusive relationship with the goddess and not sharing her with others.
Right. And, you know, not being a Catholic, you know, I've never been to confession, you know, but I always thought, what would that be like? Let's say if I went to the same priest with everyone in my family, and each one of us was going to get a little private time to complain about the others and confess all the ways in which, you know, we'd done each other dirt, and only the priest is going to have it all in his head. It seems to be something very strange and alienating about that. I mean, wouldn't it be nice if we could just talk to each other? But we don't.
You've got the intermediary, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And it's probably a really, really good thing, you know, that we can project ourselves on some real or imaginary concept of humanity that is better than we are. You know, when I travel in Muslim countries, people will always go the extra mile for me. You know, they'll buy me a Sprite or put me on their motorbike and ride me around. And I'll say, oh, you don't have to do that. Oh, yes, Mr. William, we do, you know, because it's our religion to help the guest. And I think, well, what a great religion.
Yes.
You know?
Of course, Christianity, I think, started that way, too. I don't know if it's still like that. But
yeah, sometimes it is. You know, I've met lots of really nice Christians, too. But anything, you know, that inspires us to be better than we normally would be is a good thing, you know. And part of The Lucky Star, you know, one reason that it's not just a completely dark and gloomy book, the way How You Are is that as Neva's disciples start realizing that they can never get enough of her, and she, you know, like Jesus, is starting to wear out, then they realize, well, they do have each other. And some of them, you know, can actually make a difference to themselves and each other by trying to love whoever is in front of them. And, you know, if there were a divine Jesus or even a historical Jesus, I'm sure that's what he would want us to do.
And there is some redemption in the book. I mean, the character Judy herself, the transgender woman, and even her boyfriend, retired policeman, you call him throughout the book.
Right. Yeah. He just seems like such a horrible, hateful person.
And he can be at times.
He can be.
Violent, and abusive.
Right. And Judy seems, you know, so messed up and really the author of her own misery so much of the time. And then after a while, through a lot of help from others in this so-called community that she has, she begins to realize that she actually likes what she is and who she is. And maybe she's not a woman or a man, but something different. And then he at some point, you know, starts admitting, yeah, that he's probably gay and that, you know, and that he loves her. And so if people are doing what they want to do, it's not so terrible. You know, one time I was in San Francisco and I went to this S&M seminar on the infliction of pain and terror. So The dominant and submissive were both women. The dominant was nailing parts of the other woman to a table.
Oh, my.
Setting parts of her on fire.
And this is all consensual.
Yeah, but there was crime scene tape around it. There was one old guy walking around it, chuckling, and the submissive was screaming. And it was like, it was horrendous. You know, it was like watching some kind of atrocity. They said, once the scene starts, you're not allowed to leave until the break. And then after the break, we're going to talk about what you've just seen. So I stuck around, and after the break, the submissive said, those were orgasmic screams. I was having the time of my life, and this is exactly what I planned out. I wanted all these specific things to happen to me, and it was just such a wonderful experience for me. And I thought, well, okay. I don't have to like doing that or having it done to me, but if two adults like it, then who am I to say?
Right, consensual. And Judy's a bit like that. There's a lot of things done to her that I don't think any of us would like.
That's right.
But she does get pleasure from that and feels it's even a loving gesture on the part of the retired policeman, her partner.
That's right. And so then it is. About halfway through the book, I was really, really blocked. And I thought it would be too easy, you know, to make it and like how you are. I've been there and done that. Let's try and actually make this a little bit helpful, a little bit inspiring to the extent that Mr. Gloom and Doom can do it. And I was up in Seattle and I was talking to these two young lesbians who were very, very helpful. And they said, I just don't know, you know, what I can do for Judy. And one of them said, well, tell me about her. I said, well, you know, she's kind of like me. She's old, a little fat, pretty ugly, doesn't look too good in a dress. She's probably not super smart, you know, and in a way, she's kind of a disgusting person. A lot of people think of her as disgusting. And one of the women said, well, then all she has to do is embrace her inner disgustingness. And that's what I do.
And there's a part where she tries out for a strip club.
Right.
And on her second attempt, she's very successful. The first one's a complete failure.
Right.
Because she accepts her disgustingness. Or
that's right. And I thought, like, what a great thing. Like, how liberating. And, you know, and one of the things I really love about a lot of these young trannies and genderqueer people and you name it, is that they don't care how people look at them, and they're going to be out front and bold and defiant and just creating a new self. And for me, like, what could be more American, you know? Walt Whitman would probably go for it, you know, or Thomas Wolfe, you know, America's the place where anyone can create his own destiny. Why
right.
not, you know?
Now, I actually have in the next question something about that. You're not just in the book, you're not just exploring the themes of divinity and celebrity, but you also explore identity in the book, accepting yourself for who you are. If you're disgusting, accept that you're disgusting, I guess. It's a big issue, of course, with, you mentioned Judy, with transgender women, not just the character Judy. She was born as a male named Frank. She always felt she was a woman.
And she was Frank because if Judy Garland had been a boy, they would have called her Frank.
And her Judy Garland's father was named Frank. I didn't know it, but when I did the research for here, the interview, he was gay.
Right. Yeah.
Really,
or bi or something. Yeah.
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 Frank, and her original name was not Frank, it was Francis.
That's
Francis
right.
Gum.
Yeah.
So close enough. In an essay you wrote on the Book of Dolores, you say, I had already reached adolescence before I realized that my nature could scarcely be changed. Hence, I might as well accept myself. At once, I felt relief. I could not be like others. Very well, I need not try. Strange to say, I then began to be liked. And since then, I have been blessed with as many loyal, loving friends as I could wish. So you could definitely relate to these characters' point of view. You don't have to be a transgender woman. You could be somebody who may have had a difficult childhood, or I don't know, people at school were making they made fun of me, and
right.
You know, and then you just feel, well, maybe I'm not fitting in. You know, what's wrong with me? But once you accept that you are who you are, it seems to have less of an effect of a power over you.
I think so. And why it is that I couldn't see that in Judy's case, since I'd sort of worked it out for me that I was always going to be an oddball and other people would just have to deal with it, but I couldn't. And then as soon as that young woman said that, you know, just she needs to embrace her inner disgustingness, it was like, oh, yeah, okay, yeah. That's what I've kind of done.
We all have it.
Yeah, we all have it. Right.
There's nobody who's not a little bit disgusting.
That's right, yeah. And then if you say, actually, yeah, this is who I am, then it's not even disgusting anymore some of the time.
Yeah, and I've read many interviews with you where you don't even pay attention to reviews. Bad review, you say you might feel bad for a few minutes. A good review, you might feel good for a few minutes, but it doesn't change the fact whether the work that they're reviewing is good or bad.
Right, because otherwise, how terrible that would be that I had no power over whether I was an attractive person or whether my books were any good. I'd rather say, yeah, let me just blame myself for all the deficiencies, and if I'm able to please myself, then be satisfied and not worry about what anyone else says. And that's why I'm a millionaire today.
After last week, I don't know, you might want to check your 401k.
That's right, yeah.
Now, most of Neva's apostles, and those are the crowd that frequents the Y Bar in San Francisco Tenderloin, are female, and they include what you describe in the book. You actually have a definition in a footnote. T-girls, so those are transgender women like the characters Judy. There's also a black transgender woman named Chantel in the book. G-girls, which stands for genetic girls, and that's a woman born into a female body.
Right.
And then L-girls, or lesbians. And you do an amazing job, at least for me, of getting inside their heads and thoughts. Very convincing.
Thank you.
And part of that, I know, comes from your own experiences becoming Dolores for the first two books in the trilogy, and part from a lot of research. And you already mentioned some of that research, talking to the two lesbian women in Seattle. So how'd you go about that? Did you do quite a bit, hanging out in the bars like the Y Bar and talking to lesbians like the women in Seattle?
Yeah, you know, and it's that 6 degrees of separation thing. If you're looking for, you know, a certain kind of person, somebody you know knows somebody who knows somebody who's going to know the person you want to talk to. You know, in my work as a journalist, too, I go to different places. And so I visited Las Vegas several times for different reasons. And so I got to interview a couple of really amazing older lesbians there who really helped me. And then there were some younger women of different ages, some were activists, some weren't. And it was quite a thrill to get to talk to them and say, you know, look, this is who I am. This is how I experience my gender and, you know, my sexual desire and so forth. And this is what I think about people who are not like me. And would you be willing to talk to me about this stuff from my novel? So otherwise, I'll never be able to know, but I can take your words and put them in someone else's head, you know, like a good appropriator,
Most of the people you asked cooperated with you then?
Yeah, everybody was really, really nice. Now, whether they'll all like the Lucky Star, I can't say. You know, I sent the ones whose addresses I had Viking send them copies. And, you know, the thing about this book, with many of my books, is, you know, there's a lot of irony in it and a lot of nuance. And so if you like the equivalent of socialist realism, let's say, whereas, you know, every lesbian has to be like this very pure and noble victim who becomes a heroine, yeah, then you might not like this.
Yeah, very unrealistic.
Yeah, that's not how people are.
Right.
Yeah, but I tried to make everybody as human and worthy of love and compassion as I could.
Have you heard back from any of the people you sent books to? Or
not yet.
Not yet.
No. Yeah.
It's early.
It's still early.
The book's only been out about 2 weeks.
Yeah, that's right.
In addition to this empathy that you felt for the characters and got inside their heads, there was an epigraph. I think it was an epigraph. It was a piece of Natalie Wood's acting advice. And you quote that in the book. She said you try to find in yourself the essence of someone else's feelings. And in the book of Dolores, you also you describe yourself not just as a writer, but as an empath. So these things come easier for you to kind of get into somebody's head. I feel a little bit of it sometimes too.
Yeah, and, you're an empathetic person for sure.
Yeah, and it generally is a bad. Well, I can't say it's a bad thing, but if you know the world in its current state, maybe all of us are empaths. You know, I feel it. I feel the stress. I feel the pain.
Right.
Yeah. Are you like that too? Do you?
Sure. Yeah. To be, you know, very empathetic is probably maladaptive unless you're a psychopath, you know, who can use your empathetic intuition to manipulate others. And then that's probably a very, very adaptive way to be, you know, some sort of emotional predator.
Wow.
Who can,
yes.
You know, just think of some of the political leaders we see.
And some of the serial killers in history.
Yeah.
They were very charming sociopaths. They used that, I guess, what they knew about others or felt about others to control them and in some cases kill them.
That's right, yeah. Goering was supposedly a really, really charming guy. And, you know, at Nuremberg, apparently, he even charmed one of the American jailers into giving him poison so he didn't have to be hanged.
Ah, that's how it happened.
Yeah.
Huh.
You know, that's pretty good after all the charges against him.
Yeah. Yes. Now, given all the diversity of female characters, and we talked about, you know, the T-girls, G-girls, L-girls, and you chose a heterosexual male, a character named Richard, as your narrator, or pretty much, I think, the exclusive narrator. He has a fondness for rum and soda pop, so we kind of know.
Yeah, he probably does not have very good teeth.
No. And he's part of that Y-bar crowd and one of Neva's apostles. So his account reads something like almost a New Testament gospel. Were you thinking of that, like kind of Matthew,
sure.
Luke, John, writing about their acquaintance with Jesus as apostles?
Yeah, something like that. And oftentimes, well, you know, the story is so preposterous anyway. But one of the many preposterous elements is that, you know, Richard, who just lives in his head, like me.
And I thought there was a little bit of you in him.
Yeah, that's right. Although maybe he's a little more far gone than I am. But then he'll start telling us what's happening inside of the hearts and minds of all of these people who are with Neva when he's not
yes,
even there.
Yes, I didn't quite get that. I didn't know if you had switched all of a sudden to a third-person omniscient rather than Richard, but you didn't.
That's
he,
right.
He just kind of, well, maybe he's empathic. You know, he just
maybe
knows,
he is, yeah.
And psychic because he knows what's going on even though he's not there.
Right. And, you know, it's sort of ambiguous in the book. You can never be sure whether actually he knows or whether he's saying, well, yeah, this is the legend, you know, this is the gospel
yes.
I'm going to write.
Right.
So
that's why all four gospels are different.
Are quite different. Yeah, that's right. And when Neva or Karen first goes to the island to become Neva, you know, he's saying, well, in her legend, this is what seemed to happen. And then, you know, the retired policeman saying, what are you talking about? That's all baloney.
Right. He likes his data. And
that's right. Yeah. And the retired policeman, in a way, is the only sane one because
he's the most rational, it seems.
Yeah, he just refuses to believe in things that don't add up. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't add up, right? That Neva goes to this island and then suddenly preserves her youth for decades, and somehow she has this sealskin pouch with infinite money in it.
$100 bills, yeah, just magically appear for her.
Right. It's just so stupid. How could that possibly be true?
But that's true with a lot of the Gospels, huh? Unless
right.
you have the faith.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, I mean, they make no sense rationally.
Right. And in Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, Gibbon said something like, you know, the test of faith is believing something that seems absolutely incredible to the profane mind. And he has the profane mind.
Now, I was also interested, Richard's the narrator. Did you pick him rather than a female? Because it's kind of somewhat of a stand-in for you as a way of kind of comment. I mean, in some of your books, you intrude as William the Blind, a character, certainly in the Seven Dreams series, and where you become the narrator, in effect. And here, I know you identify at least a little with Richard. Is that why you picked him, a male, rather than one of the female characters?
You know, in any sort of artistic endeavor, it's important to know when to stop. If you read Euripides and there are mentions of gods and goddesses, they might even appear in the play, but they don't say much. And they're enigmatic and quiet because, after all, how could we get into their heads, right? If we were to write something, you know, from the perspective of a goddess, you know, and some people do, it's a very, very difficult thing to pull off, to start off by making everything so alien. And, you know, the situation in here is already kind of alien. And I thought, there's only so far that I'd better push myself. If I start with, you know, a male heterosexual narrator, someone kind of like me, and I can then imagine how I would feel about Neva, that's a way of helping me to get into that story.
Ah.
And if I were going to write, say, from a lesbian perspective, I'd probably better do another couple years of research with lesbians to get everything right.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm not there yet. You know, I can make up convincing prostitute characters now after many years of hanging out with the real ones. But I don't feel yet that I could invent a lesbian character out of whole cloth. I think that would take much more work.
So these lesbian characters are composites of the people you met and interviewed?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so they're often saying and doing things that I saw them saying and doing. And so that's easy.
There's some dialogue that just seemed to me that you took notes while you were in a bar.
Of course.
And you got it down exactly right.
Yeah, that's what I have to do, because otherwise I'll never get it. And that's one of the weird things. You know, what is plagiarism? What's appropriation? And I figure,
oh, especially now. Yes.
It's better to plagiarize and appropriate than to make up something that you can't make up on your own very well.
Now, even with Richard as the narrator, sometimes there's an authorial intrusion, breaking the fourth wall. I think the most striking is when it's about two-thirds of the way through the book, and I know you know what I'm going to be talking about here. You got a note from your editor at Viking, and you actually put it in the text, and right in the story, right in the narrative. The note reads, "To be honest," and this is coming from the editor, "I do wonder whether some readers will simply tire of, for example, all the climaxing in the book, of all the descriptions of sex acts. Does that end up having a bit of a deadening / boring effect?"
That's right. What a good question, right?
Right. But why did you include that in the book itself rather than, say, the afterword, which is extremely candid and transparent about the writing of the book?
Because I think that's actually a perfect issue to address in the middle of the text. Some people are going to say, boy, you know, look, here's this one scene. There's a woman coming in to have sex with Neva, and she says, oh, I'm so sorry, it's my period. And then the next one comes in, and it's her period. And suddenly you start thinking, gosh, you know, it must be kind of dreary for Neva, you know, hearing the same things, having to do the same things with all these people. Each one has his or her own fetish. And
she satisfies them all.
Right.
Customizes her sex to what they're looking for.
Right. And other things, too. You know, she has to be Judy's therapist and babysitter. She has to help out the retired policeman. She does all kinds of things that are really, really tiring. And so why not? Yeah, of course, sometimes all the sexual stuff is deadening. But not always, you know. To me, like any human behavior, it's quite interesting to look at a lot of people doing something kind of similar and kind of different, and to just say, well, why are they doing that? What does that say about them? What does it say about me? And so in that sense, it doesn't matter whether it's sex or whether it's economics. It's human, so it's fascinating.
But sex is probably the perfect activity for making that exploration.
Well,
it's something that we all do, but differently, and we all have different fantasies and different desires.
That's right. Did you ever read any of the Marquis de Sade?
You had mentioned that in a recent podcast, the book in once. I listened to that, and yes, and I know you were saying, okay, we got to consider the source.
Right.
He was this guy locked up in a jail, and this is all he had, probably masturbating and writing all these sex acts. I mean, he had, 120 days of Sodom, which
right.
was pretty much one sex act after another.
That's right.
More gruesome than the next. So you were kind of thinking of that a little while you were putting all these sex acts together
Neva? Yeah. I remember, I think the first long book I read by de Sade was Juliet.
Oh, yes.
And it had that kind of feeling, you know, at first, especially, you know, for, you know, a young man like me, you know, it was very titillating. And then I really enjoyed the crazy, eloquent speeches of the libertines explaining why this is nature's plan and all the rest. And then after a while, you know, okay, all right. I think I've seen this orgy before and that orgy before, and it really is kind of dreary. And yet you still think, okay, let's keep reading and find out, you know, what's going to happen. Like, I feel that way sometimes, you know, when I look at parts of the Bible, Numbers, Deuteronomy, give me a break. What dreary, cruel, awful stuff. Oh, you want to keep your bondservant a little longer, so nail his ear to the door.
Yes, you know, a lot of violence.
All that kind of stuff. You know, but then there'll be some really beautiful thing in Proverbs, or, I don't know, Matthew's probably my favorite of the Gospels. And so why not, you know, accept that sort of experience?
I think I found the sex in your book similar. Some was dreary and repetitive, and then I think I found some erotic.
That's good.
Yeah. And I feel the same way about de Sade.
Right, yeah.
Though I think you had more of a point in what you were doing than him.
That's right.
I think he was just entertaining himself while he was locked up, more or less.
I think so, too, yeah.
You have some higher aspirations in your novels.
Yeah, I want to contribute to your home life. Yeah.
Now, The Lucky Star, as we mentioned, takes place in San Francisco in this Tenderloin district where the Y Bar is. And you're very familiar with that part of the city, going back to the Rainbow Stories in 1989, which I think was your second book.
That sounds right, yeah.
I find you both a scribe and a poet of San Francisco. I mean, it was a love letter to the city, but a realistic one. And I kept looking up places like the Ready Hotel. Some of them exist and some you made up.
Right.
The streets you didn't. I mean, and I know San Francisco, not as well as you, but I know San Francisco. So I was wondering what you found. It's a changing city. You know, it's becoming
right.
gentrified with the high-tech folks, more and more expensive to live there. How has the Tenderloin changed for you since the Rainbow Stories 1989 to the Lucky Star, which is circa 2015?
Well, yeah, the Tenderloin and the Mission, you know, are not as menacing late at night. In some ways, they're better, kinder places. A lot of immigrants have moved in. In the Tenderloin, you know, I've seen people from India cycle in, people from Cambodia, so forth. And suddenly you see little Asian kids playing, you know, and outside at night on the sidewalk, which is kind of nice. But, you know, the Tenderloin, you know, was always sort of the little haven for vice, yeah.
Right, yeah.
And it's unlike, say, New York, San Francisco is contained and constrained by water. And so when you go from one area into another, the boundary is very, very sharp because it doesn't have room to spread out. Mm-hmm. And so when you go in and out of the hard places of the Tenderloin, you feel the change in about half a block. It's quite interesting. And having gone out with
just a block or so from Union Square, which is this big tourist place.
That's right, yeah. And I went out with the Vice Squad for Rainbow Stories, and they told me, yeah, you know, we can't erase it, so all we can do is contain it. So we make sure it has to stay in this particular area.
Ah, so what goes in that area is okay. It's like this demilitarized zone or something.
Kind of like that, yeah. So there's still a little bit of that feeling, you know, that certain things will happen in the Tenderloin that won't happen elsewhere. But also there are more techies and other relatively high-income people who have really changed the character of San Francisco. And so you might see some of these people come into a place like the Y Bar.
And they do in the book.
Yeah, just to slum it.
There's several people who don't seem like they quite belong in there. And,
right, yeah. So in a way, to me, that makes the feeling of those places a little bit more sad, you know, to have these rich visitors, you know, who are talking about churning out content, all that.
Yes,
crap, yeah.
You have some great dialogue in there, but there, yeah, that biz speak.
Yeah. yeah, that's all verbatim.
I was thinking that was true. Yeah. It just seemed so perfect.
Yeah,
and I was
right.
In the business world for a while, so I mean, that's how we talked.
Yeah, that's right. And it's more that way all the time. It's so crazy now. This.
Especially in San Francisco. Yeah. With the high tech.
Right. So I would say the way that it's changed, you know, is that it's a little bit more under threat. And if there were a place like the Y Bar, it probably would be struggling. It would have to compromise. And of course, it would want, you know, the rich Germans or the rich millennials or whoever to come there so it could raise the price of the drinks. And then that would squeeze out
the people who can't afford those prices.
Yeah. Yeah. Neva's regulars. Yeah.
Right. Now, before we wrap up, I always enjoy asking about your current projects because there's usually multiple projects, yeah, things you're working on. We talked about the completed manuscript, How You Are, and I hope that sees print soon.
Oh, thank you.
You also have a novel called A Table for Fortune set in Redding, California. Is that completed?
It's set all over the place. And
oh, okay.
I have it under contract to turn in by 2022. I've been working on it for about 3 or 4 years now.
Is that the spy novel? The rogue, I have down here, the rogue son of a CIA agent hiding out in the wilds of the Sacramento River Delta?
Yeah, among other places. Yeah.
Okay.
So I don't know if I told you about that story before, but I can tell you if you want.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Well, is that the one that originated when you met the editor of a newspaper from Reading, and he met you in an airport and then offered you some money to write an article, and that turned into this book?
Was that's what helped me bring the character of the son alive.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. The father is a good, true-believing Cold Warrior who joins the CIA fresh out of Vietnam in 1968, and he stays with the agency until at least Trump's election. So I've interviewed some retired CIA people and you know, one current one so far, and just to kind of try to understand the mindset. To me, the worst thing that our country has ever done in my lifetime was the torture and extraordinary rendition of the Bush years. And, you know, when we hear our stable genius in chief saying that, oh, you know, we should bring back more of that stuff, then I have to assume that it's still going on. It probably never stopped. And
they certainly seem to normalize things like waterboarding.
Right, yeah.
This administration.
Right. And so my impulse is to say that those people are not Americans and that they should be sent to do a life sentence in The Hague. But then I remember when I was writing Dying Grass, and I started out by thinking that General Howard was just a villain.
But, I remember that, yeah, yes.
But, you know, having that maladaptive flaw of empathy, I quickly started thinking, well, what would I do if I were him with his Civil War experience, his religious pieties, his desire to do good, his own particular education. And so when I started asking some CIA people, well, you know, why was it necessary to torture people? And they were saying, look, Bill, we were haunted. We had a massive failure on our watch. And we were so terrified that this was going to happen again. It could have happened again. And it was up to us to protect you guys. And I thought, you know, they have a point. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that what they did was right. But until I can say, all right, if I were in the CIA, I was a career officer, I'd been doing all this stuff, and then this happened under my watch, and here's what I would have done differently, then who am I, you know, to say they're bad people? So my CIA character is a really good person. He's an analyst in Langley. So he starts off with East Germany. So I've been doing a lot of research in the Stasi archives. Mm-hmm. And because the East Germans were imperialists just like us, they were in Angola and all over the place, slowly he gets himself sucked into Iraq.
Ah.
And so he's under a real handicap because his son wants to know, well, Dad, you know, why are all these things happening? How can this be right? And he's not allowed to say. You know, and when I ask these CIA guys, well, what's it like for you not being able to tell your family what you know? You know, they usually say, well, I can always make my point just from something in the newspaper. But I can't believe that. There have to be things that they know that if only you could see it my way, you'd understand.
Right,
you know?
But they can't say.
Right. Yeah. And so the son becomes very disillusioned in 2004, and he's sort of a holy fool. You know, he's not super smart. He doesn't have a great attention span, but he's very sincere and has a good heart, and he'll pick up anything and read it. So he quickly becomes homeless. He's homeless in Portland and Seattle and all over the place. And at first, like, you know, most of the homeless, he goes into the library to get out of the rain.
Right.
And then he gets bored and starts picking up books. And then he gets a notebook and starts writing things down. And pretty soon he's trying to figure out what America is, what it should be. And so it's about the contrast, you know, between the father and the son, each of them trying to follow, you know, what they think should be the guiding spirit of America.
Is that the purpose of your upcoming trip to Iraq?
Yes. Yeah. I hope to interview a bunch of our victims from Abu Ghraib.
Oh. My. And then the other project, I know you're working on the library here. You were looking through presidential speeches from LBJ through, probably up to the current holy fool. And
right.
He's not quite holy, or well, he's a fool, maybe.
It seems like it.
The holy. Just
yeah. That's right.
So that's for a totally different book, though.
No,
right?
That's for this
book. Oh, for this one, okay.
I need to read what the presidents were saying in each one of these years.
Ah.
And, you know, imagine you're this analyst at Langley and, you know, they say, all right, you need to focus, you know, on East Germany and what's going on there. So every time a president goes, you know, to West Germany, the analyst has to spy on all these people and put everything together and say, okay, now Kissinger probably needs to know this.
Mm-hmm.
And then every time there's a terrorist attack, like say in Jordan, he's got to look into it, and he sees, oh, actually, it looks as if the East Germans might have actually, you know, sent some stuff to this. And so in his weird, very limited role, he's throwing out all of these thought tentacles all the time. And so it's this insanely difficult thing to write. You know, it's just moving all over secret world politics. Fortunately for me, you know, I can pick up declassified stuff when I go to the Nixon library, or even history books that quote things that, you know, are not classified anymore. But back then, oh, this would have been the deep, dark secret, you know, that this guy knows. So that's kind of fun.
And, well, I look forward to reading that. So that'll be about 2 years from now.
Oh, Yet I'll finish it 2 years from now, so maybe 3 or 4 it'll come out. Yeah.
Okay. Is there another book that's due to come out between now and the
Table for Fortune?
Table for Fortune.
Nope, that is it.
Ah.
Yeah. So
that's so unlike you.
I know, but you know, I never completely recovered from carbon etiologies. It just was such a massive project.
Yes.
And then after that, I got cancer. So I am just slowly getting stronger so I can do more.
Okay. And I won't even ask you about the last two volumes of The Seven Dreams at this point.
well, I've dabbled in those a little bit from time to time. Yeah.
Right. Only two left to go.
Yeah, that's right.
Easy for me to say.
If all goes well, yeah. Right.
Well, Bill Volman, it's always a great pleasure and joy for me to talk with you.
Oh, likewise, my friend.
Yeah, I always look forward to it. Thanks very much.
Oh, thank you, Ken.
We've been talking with William T. Volman, author of the new novel, The Lucky Star, from Viking Press. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KABU Community Radio. Many thanks to Bill for visiting us at KABU and to all of you for listening.